Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Up front next, Trump's legal problems mounting. A Georgia prosecutor zeroing in on the president, investigating his pressure on the state's top election official to overturn the election. As the January 6th Select Committee zeroes in on Ivanka Trump, asking her to sit down for an interview in a letter that is revealing some incredible new details. Plus, President Biden tries to clean up comments he made, world leaders say, gives Putin the green light to invade Ukraine. Tonight, we're going to take you there live. And Biden opening the door to a scaled back, build back better bill. But how much can you scale it back and have it be building back better? Will Democrats go along? Let's go out front. And good evening. I'm Erin Burnett. Out front tonight, closing in on Trump. Big blows to the former president tonight. First, closer to criminal charges in Georgia. The Fulton County DA writing tonight. Her office found, quote, possible criminal disruptions and has opened an investigation into any coordinated attempts to unlawfully alter the outcome of the 2020 elections. The operative word there, criminal. And tonight, the Georgia prosecutor requesting a special grand jury to force witnesses to testify. All of this investigation centers around the Trump phone call with Georgia's Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger.
All I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have.
And Georgia, just one of the hits Trump is taking tonight. The January 6th committee taking a huge step today. They sent this 8-page letter to Ivanka Trump, full of never-before-seen texts and details. And a lot of the revelations in this letter come from the man I'm about to show you, Keith Kellogg. Then the Vice President Mike Pence's national security advisor. You see him there. He was in the room with Ivanka Trump and the former President Donald Trump on the morning of January 6th. According to the committee and what we found out today, he provided a firsthand account of a phone call that he and Ivanka saw, observed, were in the room for, between Trump and Mike Pence, the vice president, that morning. And his testimony is cited in the letter. The committee asks Kellogg, and I quote, another report of this phone call is that Trump said, Mike, it's not right. You can do this. I'm counting on you to do it. If you don't do it, I picked the wrong man 4 years ago. You're going to wimp out. Do you remember anything like that? The committee asks Kellogg. Kellogg responds, words like that, yes. And according to the committee, Kellogg testified that at the end of this call between Trump and Pence, Ivanka Trump turned to me, quoting the letter, and said, Mike Pence is a good man. I said, yes, he is. Well, here's something else we didn't know in this letter. They talk in here about a text from someone outside the White House urging Team Trump to do something, anything. We hadn't seen this before. The text reads, is someone getting to POTUS? He has to tell protesters to dissipate. Someone is going to get killed. The response from a White House staffer, quote, I've been trying for the last 30 minutes, literally stormed an outer oval to get him to put out the first one, referring to the first tweet. It's completely insane. Well, around that time, again, according to Kellogg's testimony, as recounted here in the letter, the White House was relying on it to be Ivanka. Ivanka to be the one to get through to her father. The letter says, the committee asked Kellogg, quote, he didn't say yes to Mark Meadows or Kayleigh McEnany or Keith Kellogg, but he might say yes to his daughter. Kellogg answers, exactly right. She was the one that all eyes turned to that day. And then there's this. The committee say in here that they want to know more about what Ivanka knows about this video. You remember the video, the one that was done hours into the whole thing at 4:17 on January 6th, this one?
This was a fraudulent election, but we can't play into the hands of these people. We have to have peace. So go home. We love you. You're very special.
Okay. We all remember that, right? It came hours into the whole thing. We learned today from this letter something crucial, and that is that Trump filmed multiple takes of that video and that those multiple takes are in existence. And in take after take, Trump did not say, go home. In take after take, he did not call off his supporters who were attacking the Capitol. What he did do was call the insurrectionists very special. Did not say, go home. We now know multiple takes are there. That happened and they exist. And the news tonight from Georgia and from the January 6th Select Committee in Washington is adding to a building crisis for Trump this week. Yesterday, the Supreme Court allowed more than 700 documents from Trump's White House to be sent to the January 6th Select Committee. And in New York, the Attorney General, Letitia James, revealed her investigation into the Trump Organization, she says has the goods, has uncovered a number of, quote, misleading statements and omissions in financial statements. It's important to note that James' investigation is civil, but it is running parallel to a criminal investigation led by Manhattan's DA looking at some of the same conduct. Jamie Gangel is up front live in Washington to begin our coverage. And Jamie, I know you have been talking to your sources about this letter, these 8 pages, and we find a whole lot of new information in here. What more are you learning about what they want from Ivanka Trump?
Erin, I don't think we've ever seen a letter like this from the committee. And it's really worth people going online and reading the footnotes because it gives you a clue, more than a clue, a roadmap to how much the committee already has. My sources tell me that you'll see in here it says documents on file with the Select Committee. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. This is testimony, witnesses. This has nothing to do with the National Archives. They haven't even really gone through that yet. So what do we know from this letter? We've heard before that Ivanka went to the Oval Office multiple times to try to get her father to say something to stop the riot. That's been reported before. But what this letter reveals, very, very pointed questions that they have for Ivanka Trump. And it's based on, to your point about Keith Kellogg, new texts, new testimony, not just from Keith Kellogg, who's considered a Trump loyalist, but from former press secretary Kayleigh McEnany. Those are brand new texts the committee now has that we've never seen before. Very specific topics. They want to ask Ivanka Trump about her father's state of mind. They want to know why he didn't go down the hall to the briefing room to make a statement to call off the riot. And one of the things that I've never heard before that I think is really an explosive headline is that Ivanka Trump on the morning of January 6th was in the Oval Office and she heard her father on the phone mm-hmm. pressuring Mike Pence. She is a firsthand witness to Trump trying to get Pence to overturn the election.
All right, so Jamie, please stay with me. I want to bring in Dana Bash now, our chief political correspondent and co-anchor of the State of the Union, along with Ellie Honig, the former assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. So, Dana, you hear this reporting, you've read the letter, you hear Jamie's reporting. We know that Ivanka and her husband, Jared, have always played a coy game. They want credit with being the closest advisors to the presidents. They want to be the one to benefit in every way that that entails. But then they quickly distance themselves when things are tough or uncomfortable. They're the normal ones that can go to the normal social events. The truth holds, though, Dana, nobody knows more than Ivanka Trump does about Donald Trump's thoughts, his feelings, his intentions, his mind that day and after.
That's exactly right. And as Jamie was just reporting, you cannot overstate how much influence the former president's daughter slash senior advisor had on her father, not just in personal terms as a daughter, but much more importantly, for 4 years as a senior advisor. And that is why people would go to her when they wanted to try to get to her father on days that were not January 6th, on the other 4 years leading up to that day. But on that day, clearly from what we are hearing from this letter, there was even more pressure on her to be the person to finally get to her father. And it's really noteworthy that there was actual testimony from somebody, as Jamie said, was a Trump loyalist explaining that dynamic. Doesn't say anything about whether Ivanka Trump will actually come, because we have to emphasize that she was asked to come voluntarily. But I just want to add one other note.
Yeah.
We have reported months ago about the disconnect, intentional disconnect by Jared and Ivanka Kushner in order to distance themselves from him politically. You talked about the normalcy, trying to be normal. I'm told that that is still the case. They're still family. They still spend time together. But on politics, they're trying to stay away still 1 year later.
Right, right. And I know trying to, you know, build business relationships with people, certainly in the Middle East, you know, money involved for them as well. Ellie, in the letter, you know, I want to hone in on this part here about this phone call, right, between the president and the vice president that Ivanka Trump was there for. The committee writes, quote, "Testimony obtained by the Select Committee indicates that members of the White House staff requested your assistance on multiple occasions to intervene in an attempt to persuade President Trump to address the ongoing lawlessness and violence. Published reports indicate that Senator Lindsey Graham called you during this period, pleading that the president, quote, asked people to leave. In his sworn testimony, General Keith Kellogg explained that White House staff wanted the president to take immediate action to quell the unrest. The president was, according to one account, stubborn, and staff recognized you may be the only person who could persuade him to act. Testimony also suggests that you agreed to talk to the president, but had to make multiple efforts to persuade President Trump to act." So, Ellie, that, you know, talking about going into the Oval Office, and as I mentioned, also the phone call that she was there for. In all of this, we see, yes, text from Kayleigh McEnany. There's a lot of new stuff in here, Ellie, but it does seem to rely very heavily on unseen details by us from General Kellogg. What is the strategy behind that, having to rely on him?
I think what the committee is doing here is they're showing Ivanka Trump and they're showing all of us. We already know an awful lot about what was going on inside the White House before, during, and after January 6th. And you, Ivanka Trump, were a crucial player in all of this. As that excerpt you just read shows, even very powerful, well-placed people recognized that Ivanka Trump was really the only person capable of even trying to talk sense to her father, not particularly successful, on January 6th. But that's how crucial she was. And Aaron, you said something I think very important earlier, that Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner try to keep up this sort of duality as detached and the adults in the room. But if you look at it, they are witnesses. They are crucial witnesses. And Ivanka's responsive statement that came out today in response to this letter, I found to be so disingenuous, because her representative said, well, Ivanka didn't speak at the rally and she's opposed to police violence and disrespect of the police. I mean, first of all, she tweeted originally that the people who stormed the Capitol were great patriots. She deleted that. But second of all, if she really believed that, she would testify. She's not above this because she's the former president's daughter. She has crucial evidence. And if she meant what she said, she would testify.
And Jamie,
I know she won't, but she should.
Well, and this is the point, Jamie. You know, the statement did seem to be very, I'm too good for this. It said, this is what we got from the spokesperson. Quote, Ivanka Trump just learned that the January 6th committee issued a public letter asking her to appear. As the committee already knows, Ivanka did not speak at the January 6th rally. As she publicly stated that day at 3:15 p.m., any security breach or disrespect to our law enforcement is unacceptable. The violence must stop immediately. Please be peaceful. I mean, that has absolutely nothing to do with what they're asking her to talk about. I mean, it's just like, I'm going to put out a statement about something else. So what does the committee plan to do if she doesn't say, okay, actually, I'm going to come answer your questions?
So we've seen a history here where the committee will invite someone and then will subpoena them. We're not there yet. Let's see what happens. Although the committee has said that they won't rule something like that out. I think there's something else very important about this letter and about Ivanka Trump and Keith Kellogg and Kayleigh McEnany. Once again, what we are seeing here is that the committee has information from Trump's inner circle. These are people he thinks are loyal to him. And they are telling the committee, firsthand, fact witnesses, what was going on. That is not good for Donald Trump.
And Dana, that's not the only thing, right? In the past couple of days, you have this news, you have the Georgia news, you have the Supreme Court completely shutting Trump down on his efforts to withhold 700 documents from the committee, that grand jury and criminal charges in Georgia, the New York Attorney General, right? She says she's got the goods on Trump and his children lying each of them by name to obtain loans and insurance. There's a parallel criminal investigation going on. And this is happening, Dan, as Trump's back out, doing rallies, doing interviews, clearly wanting to jump back into the presidential race, it seems. Does any of this impact what he does?
Absolutely, it could. People who are around him and have known him for a long time have told me over and over again there are two things that would keep him from running again. Number one, his health, if he had a health issue. And number two, if he were in serious legal jeopardy. Now, we have seen him, depending on the level of real legal jeopardy, try to deflect and actually use it to his political benefit. So we have to see. Mm-hmm. But there's no question that all of the things that you just described are not good for the former president for lots of reasons, for legal reasons, for historical reasons, and for political reasons. But I think that what Jamie said about the fact witnesses and the people around the president, former president, is so important because they were relying only on that to get to where they are today. Now, the Supreme Court, which we don't need to remind people, but it's worth saying, is included on the Supreme Court are three Trump appointees. They all said, or at least the majority said, that it's okay to give his records to this committee. That means that there's so much more information that they're going to see, and we now know that they already have a good deal.
Right, right. And as Jamie said, they haven't even had a chance to go through all that. And as you point out, all three of the justices appointed by Trump did vote against his case in this specific instance. So, Ellie, one thing I've got to ask you about Georgia, because I mentioned it obviously today, the developments there. The DA investigating former President Trump's efforts to overturn the election in Georgia specifically has now requested a special grand jury. In the letter, the word criminal is invoked. What does this signal?
Well, Aaron, it tells me the DA is getting serious down in Fulton County, Georgia. Now, it does not mean there will certainly be an indictment. It does not mean the DA will even ask a grand jury eventually for an indictment. But this gives the DA crucial tools that, frankly, I don't know why it took her a year to get to this point, but we'll leave that to the side. Now, through this grand jury, the district attorney has the ability to issue subpoenas. She says in her letter requesting it, key witnesses have declined to talk to me voluntarily, including, she mentions, Brad Raffensperger. So I need subpoenas. That is a crucial tool that any prosecutor uses. And by the way, these are prosecutorial subpoenas. These are not congressional subpoenas. Nobody messes around with these. If you get one of these, you have to testify in front of a grand jury. And if you don't, you will be brought in to do so.
All right. Thank you all very much. And next, more breaking news. President Biden trying to clean up remarks about Russia. And right now, Ukrainian officials tell CNN he must do more. We are live on the ground in Ukraine with the latest with our Matthew Chance. Plus, Senator Joe Manchin speaking out, saying Build Back Better, anything about that's got to start from scratch. And the idea of an election police unit picking up steam in Georgia after taking a cue from Florida. Tonight, President Biden, quote, must do more. That is what a senior Ukrainian official just told our Matthew Chance about U.S. efforts to deter a Russian invasion of Ukraine. The official making clear that the threat of new sanctions, even the incredibly severe ones the U.S. is threatening, is not enough, especially in the wake of President Biden saying a minor incursion by Russian troops into Ukrainian territory could lead to, well, nothing or a much lesser response, you know, that some kind of incursion is okay. Today, Biden tried to clean up those comments.
I've been absolutely clear with President Putin. He has no misunderstanding. If any assembled Russian units move across the Ukrainian border, that is an invasion. But it will be met with severe and coordinated economic response. Russia will pay a heavy price.
Matthew Chance is out front from Kiev. And Matthew, obviously, this has really roiled the waters there. What more are you hearing from Ukrainian sources tonight?
Yeah, it's really stirred things up. And you don't often see a kind of public spat between these two allies, the Ukrainian leadership that depends so heavily on the United States for political, diplomatic, and military support. But those comments by President Biden really kind of causing the simmering frustrations in the relationship that were kept very much behind the scenes to sort of come out a bit more and to, in some instances, boil over. One Ukrainian official spoke to me tonight about how the United States must really ramp up its efforts to deter a Russian invasion, because he said that ongoing threat that the United States is making to impose crushing sanctions on Russia if it invades is simply not having the deterrent effect that is necessary. They want immediate sanctions imposed ahead of any Russian invasion, like, for instance, stopping the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline from working, in order to really punish Russia for its aggression and for its stance against Ukraine. Also, a lot of complaints behind the scenes here in Kiev amongst officials about what they call the slow pace of US military aid to this country. I know that's been stepped up. Hundreds of millions of dollars of military aid from the United States to Ukraine has already been forthcoming. But you know, the Ukrainians say they want heavy weaponry. They want anti-aircraft facilities. They want anti-missile batteries. Here's what the official said to me. We want patriots. If we've got patriots, then we stand a chance of holding back a Russian invasion. If we haven't got patriots, the anti-missile defense systems, of course, then, you know, we don't stand a chance. And so, you know, these are just some of the frustrations that, you know, we're being briefed on, you know, I'm being briefed on, you know, behind the scenes in this sort of ongoing sort of moment of tension, perhaps you can call it, between the United States and its ally Ukraine.
All right, Matthew, thank you very much. And I want to go now on the back of Matthew's reporting to Democratic Congressman Adam Smith, because he is the chair of the House Armed Services Committee and just received a classified briefing on Ukraine. Senator, let me just start by asking you then a chance to respond to what Matthew just reported, right, that they say patriots. If we get Patriot anti-missile defense systems, we're okay. If we don't, we won't. It comes down to that. Are you for doing that?
Well, I don't think that's militarily accurate in terms of if they had patriots, they could stop the Russian invasion. But I think what's clear from the reporting is, you know, Ukraine is in an incredibly difficult situation and dangerous situation, and they want help. And I think we need to be clearer about our support for them. And I think there are more weapons that we can provide to them and we can work with our allies to provide them. I completely agree with the Ukrainian government. We need to send a clearer signal that we will help them, you know, thwart a Russian invasion and make it a very high cost effort for Putin. More needs to be done. I don't agree that a few Patriot missile batteries are the decisive factor at this point.
So that, which is, I think, important that you lay that out. The Ukrainian intelligence reports that Matthew Chance has obtained, they say 127,000 Russian troops are near the border with several tens of thousands more ready. Seth Jones with CSIS, you know, we showed some pictures with us that showed hundreds of battle tanks, self-propelled howitzers, multiple rocket launch systems, short-range ballistic missile systems, all of that in these pictures right within striking distance of Ukraine and the capital. I know you're limited with what you can share, Chairman, but are you more or less worried tonight about a Russian invasion after your briefing?
Well, more without question. I mean, there is a sense, and you've reported on it widely, it's nothing classified, that Putin is, you know, seemingly more each day inclined to invade. Now, it's also very clear no set decision has been made, but the threat is growing. And I think our response and the forcefulness of our response needs to take that into account. We're no longer in a position where we're simply trying to dissuade him from moving down this road. He's moving down this road. So I think we need to be more aggressive about, you know, taking steps to get him to stop.
So let me ask you about that, because that gets to the heart of this whole issue about what type of an incursion is acceptable versus isn't, right, to Biden's comments. Look, President Biden has been clear he doesn't want to send U.S. forces into Ukraine, right? He has said that publicly. So far, no signs that the sanctions thus threatened are deterring Putin, as you just laid out. But the big thing we learned last night is it appeared NATO is not united on how to respond. Because one diplomat from NATO told CNN about the minor incursion comment from Biden that there's some truth there. There's some truth there. Okay. Did President Biden simply say what the reality is, which is that, you know, if you don't have NATO on board and Europe on board with sanctions and some incursions are okay and others aren't to them, there's not so much the U.S. can do?
No, it's not true. I mean, it is accurate to say that the various NATO countries are not necessarily in the same place. It is not accurate to say that absent all of the NATO countries being 100% on board, there isn't anything we can do. There is a lot that the U.S. can do. There is a lot that we can do with the allies in NATO who support us in terms of how aggressive those economic sanctions are. They have not been as aggressive as they could be in terms of outright canceling Nord Stream 2, which, you know, we can certainly put pressure on Germany to do, which we could put sanctions in place that would effectively do, and we could.
Do you have any belief, though, that Germany would do that? I mean, that would really hurt them.
Well, that's why I just said either we persuade Germany to do it, or we can impose the sanctions that would make it happen anyway. So there are options there. And then the last point is on the weaponry that could be provided to Ukraine, because certainly this is about Ukraine. But understand what Putin is doing here. I've read a lot of reporting about, well, why is Putin doing this? It's hard to figure out. Putin's been very clear for going on over 15 years now. He wants to reconstitute the Soviet Empire. Yeah. He considers its destruction a great tragedy. And Ukraine is but one step in that. Whatever one feels about Ukraine, and I feel it is very much worth helping to protect, this is about more than that. So if we can provide weapons so that even if Putin does invade, it is a very costly invasion that makes it clear to Putin and Russia that it was not a smart thing to do, that too is important. That's why providing the weaponry, providing aggressive economic sanctions is important. But I think the president made it clear this morning, and I wish he had made it clear yesterday, there is no like minor incursion that's okay. What the Russians did in Crimea, what they did in the eastern Ukraine in 2014, that wasn't okay. And any further step, no matter how small, into Ukraine is something we will not support and not let pass.
All right, Chairman, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thanks, Erin.
And next, a blow to President Biden's agenda tonight from Senator Joe Manchin. He says that Build Back Better, if there are negotiations, they have to start from scratch. Is the White House even prepared to do that? Secretary Pete Buttigieg is next. And a Republican candidate for governor in Georgia, now echoing Florida's Ron DeSantis, calling for a election police force. New tonight, Senator Joe Manchin signaling a very tough road ahead as the White House vows to pass, quote, big chunks of President Biden's domestic agenda during his second year in office. Nancy Pelosi panned that, but so did Manchin, telling CNN when asked about the future of Build Back Better, and I quote Senator Manchin, I'm open to start with a clean sheet of paper. We'll just be starting from scratch whenever we start on that. Manu Raju is out front live from Capitol Hill. And Manu, you spoke to Senator Manchin about all this today. Look, he full well understands that when all of this fell apart, he had indicated he was on board with several things already in there and that the kind of perception was, well, if we come back to the negotiating table, we're starting pretty far along. He clearly wanted to tell you something very different today.
Yeah, he made it very clear that they're going to start over here. And in fact, remember last month, he offered the White House $1.8 trillion, had a whole wide range of things indicating that he could support. Ultimately, those talks fell apart over Manchin's refusal to accept an expansion of the child tax credit, which has since expired at the end of the year. Well, Manchin says that that $1.8 trillion offer that he had is no longer on the table, saying they need to negotiate essentially from the start. And he also told me that he has not spoken to the president about this issue in detail, not engage in negotiations about this since late last month, and also setting a very high bar to all of this. He says in order to move forward, they need to get inflation under control and also COVID under control.
Is $1 trillion, is that still too, is that too much money for you?
No, I really don't mean it. The main thing we need to do is take care of the inflation, get your financial house in order, get a tax code that works, get COVID out of the way, and then we'll be rolling.
Now, amid all of this, he has faced enormous criticism from many in his party, including the independent from Vermont, Bernie Sanders, who says that him and Kyrsten Sinema are undermining Joe Biden's agenda. And when I asked Manchin about that accusation, he said, I'm not a Washington Democrat, so the base they have is a different base than I have. Aaron?
Wow. Which, you know, again, these words are all chosen to be carry the barbs that they carry. Manu, thank you very much. And I want to go out front now to Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg. And Secretary, I really appreciate your time tonight. So Senator Manchin, you know, he knew what he was doing today when he said this, right? I'm open to start with a clean sheet of paper. We'll just be starting from scratch. Were you surprised by that? Are you okay with that?
Look, you know, as somebody who's working a lot with the transportation bill that did pass, one thing I remember is how many ups and downs there were in that process, times that we were close to a deal, back to the drawing board. And what I've noticed as I'm going around the country talking about the bridges we're going to fix and the roads we're going to build is nobody's asking me whether the version that passed was closer to 2.0 or 3.0 or how many times we started with a clean sheet of paper. People just care about the impact on them. And I think it's going to be the same with Build Back Better. Look, we know that these are good policies that the American people correctly believe are going to make them better off overall, whether we're talking about fighting inflation, lowering the cost of insulin, lowering the cost of being in the workforce by getting people child care that they can afford, getting people pre-K, child tax credit, the things we have to do for our climate, you name it. These are really important policies that are going to make Americans better off, help deal with the fact that there's a lot of upward pressure on prices right now. And yeah. For that reason, we continue to believe that they're going to pass. What form it's in, what legislative vehicle it's in, the ups and downs and twists and turns on Capitol Hill, that's going to continue to, I'm sure, be a long, drawn-out story. But at the end of the day, these are good policies that have to get done, and we're going to keep pushing for them.
So I know you attended a meeting at the White House today with President Biden's infrastructure task force. And that's the group, you know, you're working with to implement the $1.2 trillion infrastructure package. Obviously, that is something that both Obama and Trump failed to do. Biden did do, and he's touted it as his biggest achievement thus far. But as we all know, whether it be, you know, voting rights or Build Back Better, it's just a part of his agenda. What gives you the confidence that you're going to get Build Back Better, considering what it's been through? I mean, it's been battered. I understand your point about making sausages ugly, but this has been particularly ugly.
Yeah, and I remember how many times they said the transportation bill was dead, too. Look, you look at the last year. This is the one-year mark for this presidency.
Yeah.
And you look at where we started out. You know, a year ago, in terms of the public health situation, you know, less than 1% of Americans vaccinated. Now, more than 200 million Americans protected. Is the job done? Of course not. We're dealing with this variant and a lot more. But look at how far we've come. The economy in grave danger. And now unemployment below 4%. Unemployment claims lowest level since the 60s. Does that mean the job is done? Of course not. We're looking at inflation, a lot of other issues, but extraordinary progress. And the same thing with this bill. I mean, the president inherited a deeply, frighteningly divided country. It remains so in many ways. And yet this bill not only passed, it passed with bipartisan support. I was there with Democrats and Republicans who yep. voted for it on the South Lawn of the White House with the president. That's what gives me confidence. The fact that in 1 year, this president was able to achieve things that would define the entire term of most American presidencies tells me that I don't know exactly how, I don't know what shape it'll take, I don't know what day it'll happen, but more really good achievements are coming this year.
So let me ask you one other thing, obviously, that is top of mind right now, and that is the 5G fiasco going on. Verizon and AT&T, which does own CNN's parent company, you know, have announced a delay in launching 5G service near some airports. By the way, you got 5G in a lot of other countries, so we've been lagging on that anyway. Airlines were warning there could be dire consequences. But as you know, Secretary, the FAA has been sounding an alarm on the problem with this bandwidth and where it is on the spectrum vis-a-vis radar since at least 2015. They were saying, watch, watch, watch. Okay, that was Obama. Then comes in Trump. Federal government goes ahead anyway. They wanted the money. They sold the spectrum for $81 billion, you know, to AT&T and the other telecom companies. Isn't this a failure of the U.S. government? I mean, why did they sell something that they weren't going to then allow to be utilized safely?
Well, I do think once we have a little more calm around the situation, we're going to look back and ask ourselves some questions about how we handle these issues. They're really unsexy and really important issues. They sound super technical, but getting them right is critically important on issues like aviation safety and for our economy as a whole. But I'll tell you right now, our focus is on making sure that we handle this with a minimum of disruption. You've got 5G beginning to be activated around the country. We've got these buffer zones around the airports to make sure they're safe. I want to emphasize, by the way, that the FAA will not allow anything unsafe to go forward, which is exactly why we had this sense of urgency around this issue. But now I'll tell you, there is remarkable level of collaboration going on with the cell phone companies that have voluntarily agreed to delay the activation of some of these towers, with the equipment manufacturers making the altimeters, which is what the worry is, that the cell phone signals could interfere with the altimeters, with the airlines who have so much at stake in flights, making sure they don't get delayed or diverted because of directives from a safety concern. There's a remarkable collaboration going on right now to really minimize, and you look at what we avoided in terms of what could have happened with the delays and disruptions. And obviously our focus is making sure that process is a success. Then we can zoom out and ask ourselves some broader questions about how we handle these issues, because of course telecommunications is so important, advancing it is important, and they're going to continue to be these processes of making spectrum available and trying to get us that fast internet that we all want, just like we all want and need a safe aviation system for everybody.
All right, Secretary, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
All right. And next, the White House doing damage control tonight after Biden appeared to cast doubt on the upcoming midterm elections. And we're going to take you inside Beijing to see the incredible lengths that China is going to keeping COVID from impacting the Olympics.
Officials have told residents if they see one of the vehicles that's part of the Olympic convoys get into a crash, to stay away.
Tonight, Republican candidate for governor in Georgia, David Perdue, an enthusiastic supporter of the big lie, calling for the creation of an election police force in his state. He says to investigate election crime and fraud and arrest anyone found guilty of such offenses. An election police force? Well, that comes as Florida's Governor Ron DeSantis is asking his state legislature to set aside millions of dollars for a similar police force to investigate election fraud and answer directly to the governor. Out front now, David Becker, an election security expert with more than 20 years of experience. You know, there's something jarring about election police force. I don't know, it just sort of, you know, brings a lot of historical moments to mind, I think, for many. But how concerned are you about these proposed election police forces, David?
Well, I'm significantly concerned for a couple of reasons. First of all, we have a very good idea of how much voter fraud actually exists out there. And the amount of that voter fraud is not zero, but it's not much greater than zero. And Florida and Georgia are great examples of that. The election officials in both those states, Republicans and Democrats, do a very good job of protecting against voter fraud, and where it, in those rare cases where it does happen, prosecuting that voter fraud. Even right-leaning groups who've promoted the idea of voter fraud, like the Heritage Foundation, the Bush Justice Department, even Trump's voter fraud commission that he installed, have not been able to demonstrate any significant amount of fraud. There's a handful of cases when it happens, it's detected, right, prosecuted. And so these are unnecessary police forces that are probably more directed at the election officials who did an outstanding job in 2020 rather than at any actual threats to election integrity.
And as you point out, 0.001% of the ballots cast, right, in these crucial states, with the AP analysis. And as you point out, Republican secretaries of state, Democratic secretaries of state, you know, they all agree on this, right? They all have investigated it. And that context is really important because, you know, today you've got the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki having to clarify twice that President Biden, she says, was not intending to cast doubt on the upcoming midterm elections when he said this after being asked whether those elections would be legitimate if Congress does not pass his voting rights legislation. Here's what he said.
I'm not saying it's going to be legit. It's the increase and the prospect of being illegitimate is in direct proportion to us not being able to get these reforms passed.
That was a word sandwich. David, you know, at a time when lies have been used to sow doubt over U.S. elections, were you disappointed that Biden did not just clearly, black and white, very simply state that U.S. elections are free and fair?
Well, I'm glad the White House clarified the position today.
Yes.
And it's a fact that democracy is incredibly fragile right now, mainly because of the efforts to delegitimize elections and democracy by the losing presidential candidate in the last election and the circle of grifters that surround him. We need to stand up for our elections because the election officials around this country, Republicans, Democrats at the state level and the local level, have done a remarkable job. We are more professional now in the administration of elections than ever before. The 2020 election was the most secure, transparent, and verified election than ever before. And we need to state clearly for the American people that if you vote, your vote matters, it will count, and the result of the elections will be accurate and verifiable, and the people who take power will be the people who truly won the majority of the votes.
Right. That is the simple black and white stated answer. Thank you so much, David. I appreciate you.
Thank you, Aaron.
And next, an incredible look at Beijing and how it's handling an influx of people from around the world for the upcoming Olympics. Wait till you see this. Just imagine it happening in the U.S. or in Europe. And a surprising finding tonight about the mysterious Havana syndrome. An attorney for the victims, though, tonight speaking out, does not agree with the CIA. Tonight, Beijing officially opening the street lanes you see on your screen, meant to keep Olympic athletes and staff separated from the Chinese population. It is just one of the severe measures China is taking to prevent any COVID cases. David Culver is out front with tonight's Inside Look.
Traveling into Beijing may prove to be a tougher race than an Olympic competition. These winter games taking place in a capital city that increasingly feels like a fortress. China determined to keep out any new cases of COVID-19, starting at the airport.
This is the terminal that's going to be used by athletes, some of the Olympic personnel and media arriving into Beijing. They've got a wall up that keeps the general population away from everyone who's part of the Olympic arrivals.
Those coming in required to download this official app to monitor their health, inputting their information starting 14 days before arriving in Beijing. While health surveillance and strict contact tracing is part of life for everyone living in China, it's making visitors uneasy. Cybersecurity researchers warn the app has serious encryption flaws, potentially compromising personal health data. China dismisses concerns, but Team USA and athletes from other countries are being advised to bring disposable burner phones instead of their personal ones. From the airport, athletes and personnel will be taken into what organizers call the closed-loop system. Not one giant bubble, so much as multiple bubbles connected by dedicated shuttles. Within the capital city, there are several hotels and venues, plus the Olympic Village, that are only for credentialed participants.
The dedicated transport buses will be bringing the athletes, the personnel, the media through these gates. But for those of us who are residents outside, well, this is as close as we can get.
Then there are the mountain venues on the outskirts of Beijing, connected by high-speed train and highways, all of them newly built for the Winter Games. So as to maintain the separation, even the rail cars are divided, and the closed-loop buses given specially marked lanes.
It is so strict that officials have told residents if they see one of the vehicles that's part of the Olympic convoys get into a crash, to stay away. They've actually got a specialized unit of medics to respond to those incidents. It's all to keep the virus from potentially spreading.
It also helps keep visiting journalists from leaving the capital city to other regions like Xinjiang or Tibet to explore controversial topics. With the world's attention, the Olympics allows China to showcase its perceived superiority in containing the virus, especially compared with countries like the U.S. But this will, in many ways, also be a tale of two cities, one curated for the Olympic arrivals and pre-selected groups of spectators, another that is the real Beijing. Though some local Beijing residents are now in a bubble of their own, communities locked down after recent cases surfaced in the city outside the Olympic boundaries. A mounting challenge for a country that's trying to keep COVID out and yet still stage a global sporting spectacle to wow the world.
And Aaron, that is the real challenge, to portray this as an open, welcoming host city when you're surrounded by barriers. And we're seeing more and more broadcasters and personnel just canceling their plans to come here, in part because the realization is starting to hit. China's zero COVID restrictions, they are like nothing else in the world. And if you contract the virus, or if the government officials say that you've been a close contact to a confirmed case, there is no challenging them. They can, and most likely, put you in isolation. Aaron?
Wow, it is incredible. Just seeing those, your own streets, your own, it's unbelievable. Thank you so much, David Leiva from Beijing tonight. And next, an attorney for victims of Havana Syndrome taking on the CIA. Tonight, we finally know this for the first time about Havana Syndrome. The CIA says it hasn't yet found any evidence that a nation state is behind any of the roughly 1,000 now reported episodes to Americans around the globe. Mark Zaid, attorney for several of the victims, some of whom have suffered brain damage and more, tells me, quote, the CIA's interim conclusions are incredibly disappointing, were completely unnecessary, insulting to those who are suffering, and highly suspect. Indeed, the preliminary assertions seem more designed as a PR move to persuade its workforce to pursue overseas assignments, as many employees were rebelling against doing so in light of the increase in perceived attacks. And now the investigation goes on. Thanks for watching. It's time for Anderson.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.